So we're very glad to have you, Aaron, and I hope this signals many visits, and similar, of course, with Susan at Davis. Aaron Rodrigue is the Charles Michael Professor in Jewish History and Culture at Stanford University. He specializes in the history and culture of Sephardic Jewries. His books include Jews and Muslims, Images of Sephardi and Eastern Jewries in Transition, 1860 to 1939. Sephardi Jewry, A History of the Judeo-Spanish Community, 14th to 20th Century, that's co-authored with Esther Benbassa. And French Jews, Turkish Jews, The Alliance Israelite Universelle and the Politics of Jewish Schooling in Turkey, 1860 to 1925. His co-edited book with Sarah Abraveria Stein, A Jewish Voice from Ottoman Salonika, The Ladino Memoir of Saadi Bezalel Halevi, appeared in 2012. Aaron is a fellow of the American Academy of Jewish Research. Thank you so much. I didn't, can you share the title of your talk?
The title was Perspectives on Sephardic Studies, Past, Present, Future. So I'm going to touch upon earlier themes, elaborate upon other ones, and I'm a historian, so the natural starting point place for me is to do a little historic backward glance. And so, but before that, of course, like everybody here, I want to muse a little bit about the word Sephardi. We have problematized it, we find it as a catch-all explanation, one of the ways we can think of in some ways, but I can see the problems would be Islamicate Jews or Jews in predominantly Muslim lands, which breaks down, of course, once we come to Balkan nation states and other places. But again, that episode is so brief that, and also obviously they were living together with Christians as well as Jews. However, there is something in and I would like not to think of it as an essentialist thing. There's something to the Islamic framework, Islamicate framework, as the dominant religious and societal, discursive and legal kind of form over the centuries that does certainly do some aspect of kind of a unity, but that itself is divided by legal schools, by geography. What happens in Kurdistan is not representative of what happens in Istanbul. What happens in Istanbul is not representative of what may happen in Sudan. You know, so there are many, many problems, and it would be just as, in some ways, anachronistic to perhaps use that in a very extensive way as we would continue in the modern period, for example, say, the Jews of Christendom, which used to be used in the medieval, it's still used in the medieval world, but it is deeply problematic. So there's no easy solution. I would, however, like to sort of make a small gesture towards perhaps the overwhelmingly Islamicate world, one way or another, which does have a distinguishing marker with, after a few centuries, that does begin to make a very big difference if Jews arrive from one place and go to the other. There is also a kind of, you know, there's a kind of a need to find something about that is non-Western Europe or non-Europe or non-Ashkenazi, but then itself breaks down. And I very frequently thought of sort of multiple kind of culture areas without necessarily sort of erasing the specificity. So, for example, a North African culture area, a Levant culture area, a Judeo-Spanish sort of area in the north, and then perhaps a Persianate area in the east, all being very vague, but I think that sort of really, in some ways, identifies the major constituents of this thing we're now all calling by the name Sephardi, being non-European, all recognizing also that indeed it does include European, and we have yet to talk about Western Sephardim, who left the Iberian Peninsula and who went to just across the border of southwestern France, who went to Amsterdam, and you know, who then spread to the UK, to England, and then of course to the Americas. So where do we put them? I mean, and also to make it even more complicated in terms of the Islamicate kind of perspective, This was an amphibian Jewry already in the Iberian Peninsula, even when we're talking about the Sephardic Jews, who moved from Muslim to Christian rule that in some ways, this constant encounter with these two different traditions also has to be remembered. So I just want to complicate it a little bit more, but I think in the end, I, like others, I kind of tend to use Jews in Muslim lands, sometimes Sephardi, sometimes other. I don't think it's possible to reach any consistency. And in some ways, there is also something very strange about continuing to use these categories without specifying it, because as was mentioned, you know, Ashkenazi Jewry in and of itself in the modern period, what does that mean? You know, that itself is kind of a problematic category. So that goes back to, however, to the historical arc of what I want to talk about. And really the first major look at the Jews in Sephardic Jews or Jews in Muslim contexts really is part of the Wissenschaftliches Judentums movement that begins in Europe in the mid-19th century. And that is overwhelmingly about, of course, Iberia. It's overwhelmingly about the Judeo-Arab symbiosis, or what it was going to be called, the Judeo-Arab symbiosis. It was overwhelmingly high culture. It was all about philosophical and linguistic and poetic and all kinds of other ways. And it was all by European Jews, newly emancipated or on the path of emancipation, who were trying to find a golden past as they were justifying their way to in emancipation. You know, John Efron's latest book, but even before, there'd been the myth of Sephardic supremacy, as Ismar Shorshet put it. So that's where the whole story begins, and it really pretty much ends until it goes through the expulsion, and it very frequently then, as far as overwhelmingly ignores North Africa in terms of the Wissenschaft, except for a few who will go from Spain or from Iberia elsewhere. And it kind of comes to a dead halt in 1666 with the conversion of Shabtai Tzvi. That is the end of involvement with the Sephardim, who later on are, as 19th century a couple of Wissenschaft scholars would call them, the degenerate sons of Iberia. That basically have lost all the glory and everything they've had, mired in obscurantism and fanaticism. So that's where the story was, in fact, until large part of the Middle East, large part of the middle of the 20th century. There were others, however, as Emily mentioned, there were people in Middle East studies who, as they began to look at the Arab world and the Persian world and elsewhere, noticed Jews and began to write about them. And I won't mention the countless books by Jewish travelers in the genre of the exotic Jews in exotic lands, which is, in and of itself, actually has to be studied systematically at some moment, because it's not only fantasies, there's a lot of other kind of stuff going on, but that's a whole other issue. So I would identify in some ways that the first look at modern, with the emergence of Middle Eastern studies, the next step on the way is really very much in the field, initially of anthropology, I would say, mostly Morocco-centered, but also to some extent Iran at particular kind of moments, and, you know, occasionally going elsewhere, and then eventually moving on to history. In general, the lay of the land was in the middle of the 20th century was that this was, on the whole, a very marginal field, a very fledgling marginal field, infinitely richer for the pre-modern period than the modern period. I think that as far as medieval Jews in Muslim lands, not only Goitein, but I mean, Goitein started before the war, but you know, in a lot of other ways, I think as an extension of the medieval Judeo-Arab world's synthesis, it was easier to continue this in very many different ways well past World War II. So then I will not repeat here what Emily described. I think the growth of Jewish studies and the growth of Middle East studies in parallel, but there began to take a bifurcation, which became fairly significant and which really is problematic to this day. They say, and I'm most, of course, I know mostly history, so I will use the discipline from my own discipline. I will use the perspective of my own discipline. And that is, those who study Jews in a Muslim setting, in the modern world, I'll talk about post-1492, in a Jewish setting, in a Muslim setting, located and trained in Middle Eastern studies, and those trained in Jewish studies looking at those Jews eventually, with lots of crossovers, obviously. And obviously, the ideal world has to be both. I mean, this is not an either-or proposition. It's just the way the field kind of, the field of study has had this kind of fundamental differences with very many different perspectives as a result. I'll just give you one example. This was when I was beginning my studies, and I was talking to a major historian, an Israeli, of Ottoman, who had done late 19th century Ottoman Jewry, and I used the word, well, you know, in terms of Jews gaining civic emancipation in the Ottoman Empire, and his response was, what does emancipation mean? That is to say, the arch leitmotif of a large part of modern Jewish history and modern Jewish historiography, Jews gaining equal rights, was absent in Middle Eastern field as even as a problematic issue. Now, that doesn't make it a naturalized part of Middle Eastern history. I'm not necessarily arguing that, but it's about the way in which different historiographies and different training methods, different ideological and other kind of perspectives created kind of Fragestellung, a kind of a problematique that was not, that was different in some way. Some of the issues, so we then go into the perennial questions, all mixed up with politics, about Jews in lands of Islam. Were they tolerant of Jews, or were they always persecuted? Gets wrapped up with the Arab-Israeli conflict, which underneath still kind of undermines in some way a lot, and this is one of the very biggest problems. It is, in fact, a very great source of turbulence, if I may say, to this day in both of the fields. I think it's kind of really, really significant in both Middle Eastern studies and Jewish studies. And people are aware of this, but I think that, you know, the damage has been considerable and it is ongoing. But that is probably a subject for another talk. The issue of integration or non-integration, persecution or tolerance, a harmonious coexistence or fractured lives, hybridity or separate communities all on their own, you name it, there are multiple perspectives that you can find in all kinds of works. And that doesn't necessarily always follow in terms of the training of the students from whichever field they came, because it affects a lot of the other kind of trainings. But There are two or three things that now I see in terms of this kind of background and what we have as the field develops. One is, for whom does the historian write? What is the audience? Is it other Jewish historians? Is it global historians? Is it Middle Eastern historians? Some of these questions do not pose themselves in other fields of history. But this, I think it is, in fact, the richness of this field, that one has to constantly ask that kind of question. And what are the, in the paradigms, which are our interlocutors? That is to say, where does it all fit or does not fit? And I think that, you know, it need not always fit also. It can have its own particular valence. So I think that that's one of the big issues that come up here. But there are other very big challenges. I mentioned I will come to the issue of the conflicts and how it affects people, but there's something that is really facing us right now in the face, which I think will affect the future of the field. Large parts of the Muslim world are not accessible to historians of any type who are going to go to archives. Egypt has become virtually impossible, I'm told, because of the grave difficulties given to people in archives. Libya, I don't need to touch upon. Syria, no need to talk about. Jordan had almost no Jews. Iraq, not possible. To such a degree that actually Algeria, virtually impossible. Tunisia, to some extent. So in many ways, Morocco, where a lot of it started in terms of anthropology, still remains as a kind of an important site. And then, finally, the return of the repressed, the Ottoman archives. That is to say, there was a double displacement that had gone on. Because of the early Orientalist presuppositions of the field of Middle Eastern studies as it had emerged, where Arabic was the king, and the language of the empire which ruled it for the region for 500 years was really not a requirement. I mean, it's the equivalent of, for the European historians, of doing Habsburg history without German. It sort of became finally apparent that this was indeed an important language. And it is, so far, I hope it continues, well, I'm not necessarily all that sure, but so far it remains the only open major archive that from all of the region, to such a degree that, in fact, a lot of Middle Eastern historian graduate students are now retooling their dissertations in order to be able to continue Middle East studies by using the Istanbul archives. Now, the Istanbul archives actually happen to be a lot richer sometimes than very many local archives, and there is extensive archival material in Arabic and in Persian and a lot of other kind of things. So there's going to be no dearth of other linguistic kind of things, but you do have to have Ottoman. Just as what's happening in the Middle Eastern field, it means that the future will privilege Ottoman archives in so far, because I don't see any of these other archives opening up soon in a lot of other places. I'm really talking from the historian's perspective, okay? So because, I mean, one can always conduct interviews, although that's quite dangerous in many of the parts of this world, as we just saw. With the Italian, young Italian scholar who was killed in Cairo recently. So I think that by definition, there's going to be whatever general Middle Eastern history, Jewish history that will emerge will be somehow based in Ottoman archives. Hopefully with Persian archives opening up, there will be some other possibilities we don't know yet. And I see utterly an impossibility of any serious archival work at the moment. These are facts on the ground. I'm really reporting in terms of facts on the ground, where we'd have normally expected perhaps much more serious work being done in a lot of these countries if things had become possible. I think just the material circumstances determine in some ways the way in which the field can develop. I am not optimistic for large swathes of the Middle East and indeed North Africa for the possibilities of real archival-based research, with the exception of Ottoman archives or Moroccan archives, and of course, by extension, Southeastern European archives, where it touches upon the Sephardic world. So this is a very big problem. Actually, it's now a very big problem for Middle Eastern historians in general, because I think it kind of throttles the supply line, as it were, or for the future. I'm not sure which way this will be resolved. However, it does denature or transform scholarship in certain ways. I mean, if people cannot do archival work in a certain area, they're not going to become experts of that particular area, and they will all navigate towards what is really possible. So I think that this is a serious issue I'd like to raise this year, because I'm seeing it actually in Middle Eastern historians in general, people who are working on Arab lands becoming Ottomanists in the north, and I'm seeing it also in Jewish studies. Now, of course, given the fact that my own work comes from that part of the world, this is not necessarily a negative development as far as I'm concerned, but there is a bigger issue at play here, which I think we cannot underestimate. So I would venture to say, therefore, that, and this has already happened, I think a large part of work is going to shift and is shifting towards diasporic global studies. And indeed, it's long overdue in many ways. We know North African Jews leaving to Latin America. We know about they're in France. North Africa, France, Israel. This is the dispersion stories, which is going to gain and is gaining attraction. And these are desiderata also, Jews from the Ottoman Empire in North and South America, Latin America. Latin American Jewish studies is really a completely empty field in terms of the real cohesive view of those Jews coming from Muslim lands and their integration. Actually, it is largely non-integrated in Jewish history in general, or Jewish cultural studies in general, except for people who have come from Latin America and who do that work. And yet we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people in the Ashkenazi world, and actually tens of thousands, substantial numbers. Whether it be Brazil, Argentina, Chile, Mexico, which has all of these Jews, whether they came from Morocco or they came from Syria or they came from ex-Ottoman land, were usually known as Los Turcos because it was the Grand Turk and it was the kind of the Ottoman Empire, and there was huge issues with integration with the local Ashkenazi communities, but also towards absorption and adaptation to the new land. So I think there are some really interesting things that can be done and will be done. I think Iran is an open story, and this will depend again on the local circumstances, though the diaspora part of it can certainly be done. The ex-British Empire. I think we tend to forget there's a very large Sephardic presence in Southern Cone in Africa, just as people were going, like Syrian peddlers and Syrian groups going, and from Morocco as well, into into Africa. There are lots of Jews elsewhere, from elsewhere in the Ottoman Empire, that went there. That's Africa. Then there is the very major Baghdadi diaspora that played a huge role in the British Raj and all of the Asian, in the rise of global international trade, but also in many other ways, which really has not been studied in any kind of proper way. And there are, and indeed, the Sephardim in the United States, this kind of post 1880 emigration of the Sephardim in the United States is also just beginning. But in general, while Emily, I do agree with you that there has been a lot of move in Middle Eastern studies towards people in Middle Eastern studies studying Jews, it is still a hazardous task. The hazardous task is not of established scholars who have turned to this study, but it's about where the jobs are. This is virtually impossible today, for reasons that are identifiable, for a historian who studies Jews, let's say, in an Ottoman or an Arab land, to get the job when it's advertised as the history of that country. It is virtually impossible. Many reasons. Not all of it malevolent or problematic. It just doesn't seem as important. If you're going to do, Jews. I mean, if you're going to advertise a history of let's say, broadly speaking, the Fertile Crescent, why would you choose, if it's going to be your only historian, that of a minority? And it kind of marginalizes itself in this way. So there is a very big problem. I think almost all of the jobs are in Jewish studies. So I do not see actually a trek from Jewish studies to Middle Eastern studies. There may be a trek, i.e. it's growing. The number of people doing Middle Eastern studies or North African studies are actually gravitating to these things after they get jobs and maybe after tenure. But as beginning level jobs, and I'm sorry to be this kind of ground, let's say at this kind of level, it is a very foolhardy thing to do for somebody going into the job market in history. I think anthropology is slightly different in many respects, but in history it would be a very foolhardy thing to do for a variety of reasons, both for the endowment purposes, endowed chairs, endowed positions, endowed beginning positions, and other reasons. I foresee as far as the eye can go, really the consistent, continuing presence, and indeed now increasing demand in the field of Jewish studies for Sephardic studies as well. and I do not see it on the ground in Middle Eastern history. I really do not. I mean, it doesn't mean it would be rejected in terms of when people turn to do it, but I'm very pessimistic indeed whether that for a ending PhD person is really an open path. I think for the Arab-Israeli conflict sits there, but also, as I said, you know, it may not be very high in the order of priorities. So that's one big challenge. That itself then poses another question, which is that if there is going to be a search committee, and again, I'm sorry for identifying, but these things in the United States context mean a lot, are going to be choosing in the field, and most of them will be in Jewish history or other things, in the field of Jewish history, most of them will have come with very little exposure to Sephardic studies. What does that mean? What criteria are going to be used? And I think the criteria used in general Jewish historiography are the ones that will resonate most because that will be familiar, which does inevitably mean to some ways to the occluding, to use that word, of certain other aspects that are very valuable in the field of Middle Eastern studies because that may not come up in the regular paradigms that are being used. I think that is a real serious kind of issue. Of course, there's no question in the ideal world, as I said at the very beginning, one has to do both. One has to be amphibian, as it were. One has to be in both worlds of Jewish history and other history. And I think that in that respect, the problem is going to continue, but the future of growth is in future developments of the Jewish studies field, where increasing number of programs ask for more Sephardic exposure. Islam, for obvious reasons, has now become very much the obsession, as you know, students and others alike, and obviously people have woken up to the fact that there were Jews in Muslim lands, even in Jewish studies, and that therefore they feel the need to actually expand that. That being said, I think we have a lot to do, because even there, in Jewish history, Jews in Muslim lands are not yet integrated into the general historiography. It's an extension of the Shoah paradigm, but it goes back to the original template, in some ways, deep structure of the Wissenschaft paradigm, that it in some ways still does not really legitimize totally in general Jewish history. There's best will in the world. There is a certain Ashkenazocentrism, but that's perfectly okay, I suppose, because the majority of world Jewry was Ashkenazi, and that up to a certain point is acceptable, but there seems to be a kind of a tokenism that I think one can also identify, that say, yes, we're going to do that as well, but you know, in places where there may not be a general syllabus of modern Jewish history, let's say, there could be one little episode in one being touched upon, and then the rest of the question are not even kind of are not even approached. So I think there is a problem, but I think there's been a great deal of progress made, but we're not there yet. In the sense of integration of the field, the integration of the field in Middle Eastern studies is in Middle Eastern historiography is actually in some ways better because, of course, at some particular moment, when you're looking at a particular area and the Jews are a major constituent of that area, if you're doing Middle Eastern studies, it's that locally based. So there is a very bizarre paradox. There's a very enlightened, very inquisitive, and very cosmopolitan and worldly, scholars of Middle Eastern studies, especially of the younger generation, especially in the United States, are generally interested in including the Jews, and along the lines that you had mentioned, in their research and in their narratives, but there will be no jobs there. But in places where there are jobs, I'm not sure how much of it is really yet quite understood and absorbed. I think it's going to be, and it's made huge progress, but having being at the early stages of development in that field, and I can see an enormous development, and yet lots of issues yet to be resolved. I think that this double marginality can be a source of strength, because it can also be a source of interrogating very established and largely hegemonic sort of paradigms, and really begin to do a work of from decentering to really shake things up, and not necessarily to assert a Sephardi paradigm, but to really more to question by using that kind of off-center and the marginal to question some of the long-established perspectives that are repeated over and over again. It could be anything from literary production to role of gender, for example, which I think really has barely been touched in that respect, and there's a lot to be done. In terms of also networks that displace both the nation state and networks, trade networks, networks of sub-ethnic groups in a lot of these fields, a pan-Mediterranean perspective. So in general terms, I will conclude that we have come a long way, we have a long way to go, and a lot of the way we go is going to be, to some extent, unfortunately, going to be determined by the evolution of academia on one hand, and the evolution of on-site possibilities of research on the other hand. But I think with a whole new generations entering the field, I do think that I can only end in this Pollyannish way, that I think the future is bright, but not without its intrinsic problems. Thank you.
Any comments? Or, yeah, I think we still have 5 minutes for questions, comments, even six. Yeah,
sure. I just want to add something very fast to your comments about archival access. I would add to that list Israel, because that's not accessible to many, many scholars from the Muslim world.
Exactly.
And that's
absolutely
a big problem
of course,
as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And also there is, just to add on to that, there is a big problem about, I mean, in some ways, it's a fantastic thing that a lot of Jewish communal archives have been moved to Israel, because it makes it accessible for those who are not from the Muslim world to enter that. There is, however, another problem that, it denatures the whole archival experience, and the kind of stuff you would find in an archive, which could be classified in the next kind of place, disappears and is disembodied in a basement, usually, somewhere where it's found. So that there are the making of archives is a big issue, yes.
Aron, I wanted to ask you, as an Ottomanist and someone who knows this field very well, where would you say are the most fruitful nodes or entry ways within the vast field of Ottoman studies for a further inquiry into Jews in the Ottoman Empire, in both the pre-modern and the modern?
I think the easiest parts remain in the part sections that are in non-Arab regions. Non-Arab areas, let's say the northernmost, basically Turkey proper and the Balkans, is much more richly represented. That does not mean that, for example, a lot of something about local notables or Jewish banking families that emerged in Damascus or other places, they would have enormous amount of place there in those particular archives.
Is that kind of material fairly accessible?
It's totally open. Where it becomes problematic in Ottoman and Turkish archives is the closer you get to World War I, the more difficult the access. And by the time you enter the 1920s, it's virtually impossible. But even World War I, precisely because of the Armenian Genocide, means that all non-Muslim archives accompanied next to it, if they've been classified together, become inaccessible.
So the Atatürk era is very difficult?
Very difficult, yeah.
It was very
paradoxically, it's very more difficult.
Yeah.
But it's not impossible, but if it's like something local. There are also very good local historians working in Turkey now, so one can find a lot about certain places where Jews live, both in history and in current areas. But I think the nicest, easiest is medieval and early modern, mostly. 19th century is wide open. I don't think there are any problems working in 19th century until 1912, 1914. But then there's the other big problem is when these countries are being shedded from the Ottoman Empire. You know, what do you do with Salonika, for example, when it moves from, I mean, large chunks of the archives may be in Istanbul, because everything, you see, this is the part that people really, it's very important, because after all, this is an empire that was, at different moments, went through centralization and decentralization. So the local correspondence about issues and the vilayet, the governor's responses and reports are all in Istanbul. They're not actually in the local places. There is a lot that can be gleaned from there, and I don't think anybody has done an exhaustive study of like what would be of relevance. But I think one is on much safer ground in the let's say the Judeo-Spanish world from the when we look at it from the Sephardi angles. But I think there is a lot from Damascus, for example. Yeah.
Hi, thanks so much. I wonder to what extent you think North American discourses from ethnic studies, diaspora studies, post-colonial studies, are those having impact on Sephardic field formation?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that that's a very interesting development as well. I think in theoretical terms, in terms of a lot of theory, some of it is applicable and is being applied. Some of it is not, because in some ways, the American development of ethnic studies, which is not even comparable to anything similar happening elsewhere, is a distinctly American product, and by definition could be extremely anachronistic to apply even the categories of race, gender, all of these things that have been kind of emerged are not necessarily transposable to other parts of the world. But that does not mean, for example, in post-colonial and other kind of studies, there are not distinct moments of a great deal of crossover that is possible and that has been applied. Yeah.
Do we have time for one more? Oh,
well,
I guess that's up to me, right?
Just to sort of follow up on that question, the idea that the Wissenschaft was Orientalist became part of the Orientalist stream, that became part of the Zionist stream, that delegitimized Jewry from the rest of the world in the effort to build Israel.
No, it's not linked to Israel.
Seems to be part of that question of looking at valued histories, and the idea also that so many of Mizrahi Jews, Sephardic Jews, were fleeing quote unquote Arab lands, and then their histories got sort of put into that context of destabilization and Israel as a kind of redeemer. Isn't that very impactful? And
yes, it has been. It has been very impactful. Actually, that raises another question, which I was going to allude to, but something that's been somewhat missing. Although, I think there is one representative among us who's kind of jumped fields, that is, say, doing North Africa and the Levant, and that's Sarah, of course, with her work on Algeria. It's really shocking how little dialogue exists between North African studies and Ottoman studies. And other Jewish things. I mean, this could be a whole other subject of why it happened, where it happened, the particular place of Morocco, which wasn't part of Ottoman lands to some extent, and you know the kind of. But you know, this is not again presuming an Islamic essential thing that should necessarily unite fields. But if one could have a dialogue between, you know, increasingly, for example, French Jewry is now impossible to do without North African Jewry, and that people are doing that. And I think that for obvious reasons, but I think that there should be a lot more possibilities of this kind of dialogue, because there's a lot of dialogue between European Jewish history and certain aspects of Sephardic Jewish history. So it's not, it doesn't necessarily mean there should not be other ones. It's simply not there very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.